And then we'll get into the interview. So today is the 8th of December, 2011. This is the second interview with Arthur Babson at Siemens in Flanders, New Jersey. I'm David Caruso, and with me is Sarah Hunter as well. So I think, Sarah, you have a question?
I was curious about the end of your time at Warner Lambert, and you'd spoken so much about working independently, you know, and all of your scientific work in graduate school and postdoctorate. You're working by yourself, and suddenly over the course of some years at Warner Lambert, you have a huge group. What was that adjustment like, going from working by yourself to managing a growing group of people?
Well, I think I say in their book that I had 50 people or more, and they were less productive than when I had 5 people. Because I don't know. I was a lot more productive when I was hands-on, totally hands-on, I think.
So you were productive, as in, when you were working on something, you were literally productive with it.
Right. Yeah.
But as you became more and more responsible for a group of people, I guess there was a lot less of your own hands-on work.
Right. It was a lot of administration, administrative work, and whatnot.
So directing other people what to do?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you have as much input about things at that point with what was being designed and what was being investigated, or were you essentially just relying on reports from people about the work getting done?
Well, I had a lot of input, but not as much as I did when I was doing it myself, obviously. Mm-hmm. So I had to rely on other people.
Okay.
Other people weren't as reliable as I was.
And I know during this period of time, you have you meet Susan, your second wife. She was in your group, so you were responsible for her. Were there any issues at Warner Lambert in terms of you supervising someone whom you were married to?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, definitely. And there were a lot of petty jealousies.
Mm-hmm.
And Susan was very productive,
mm-hmm.
and she wasn't given the credit for it that she deserved, because they say, oh, that's just art,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it wasn't just me. She was a very productive scientist. But there were a lot of petty jealousies. And when I was made vice president, mm-hmm. of research, my boss, George, Masters, George Masters,
George Masters.
Who is the president of the General Diagnostics Division,
mm-hmm.
Wisely told me not to have Susan reporting to me.
Okay.
So I had her reporting to Jim Turner for a while, and then she got a job in International Division of Warner Lambert, and then eventually left and went to work for MedPen.
Okay, so she shifted around.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, again, as you moved up the corporate ladder and you were becoming more distanced from
the bench,
I'm sure that you had a lot of ideas about what could happen in the diagnostic realm. And I'm curious to know what it is that you thought was important to do in terms of standardizing diagnostics, and what sort of tests did you think needed to come up for physicians and things like that? I mean, what was your thinking during this period of time about what you wanted to accomplish?
Well, I wanted to simplify the tests that the laboratory was already running,
mm-hmm.
And improve them, if possible, to provide better results, to provide easier procedures.
Mm-hmm.
And but the tests themselves, the analytes that were tested for, that were measured, were pretty much dictated by the need.
Right. You know? The medical field has its own. We need to know something.
We need to know what your glucose level is. We need to know what your uric acid level is, and so forth.
So how did you keep abreast of what it is that physicians wanted or needed? I mean, were you attending American Medical Association conferences or?
Well, I was very active in the American Association for Clinical Chemistry, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the main meeting for the field that I was working in.
Mm-hmm.
Which was essentially clinical chemistry.
How long had you been involved in that?
I was one of the early members. My membership number is 246. There was only 243 members before I joined. And that was in early, when would that be? A year or two after I joined Warner Lambert.
Okay.
And actually, the Clinical Chemistry, American Association for Clinical Chemistry, they were kind of prejudiced against people from industry.
Why is that?
And because they thought it was their business. It was their I don't know, to tell you the truth.
Was it mostly academics in the
organization? Yeah, it was academics.
Okay.
And they thought that people from industry were kind of like harlots.
So when you were involved with this group, were you just presenting your research initially at the meetings, or was it?
No, I was on the board of directors of, or what do they call it? I'm not sure whether it's a board of directors, but of the New York Metropolitan section and then the New Jersey section. So I was involved in the organization itself.
Okay. And were you one of the only industry individuals?
One of the earliest industry individuals, I think.
Okay.
But now it's dominated by people from industry.
Okay. And what was the purpose? I'm assuming the organization had annual meetings. What
Yes.
was the purpose of the annual meetings?
To present research results and whatnot, present papers.
Okay.
And initially they didn't have commercial exhibits.
Mm-hmm.
It was just technical papers.
Okay.
That were presented, but now it's totally dominated by commercial exhibits, essentially.
The work that was being done by the academics, was it any different from the type of work that you or once more industry people started to come in? Was it different from the work that they were trying to accomplish? Was there some fundamental difference between?
Not really. They were working on methodologies, new methodologies and stuff.
Okay.
But the people from industry were working on products
mm-hmm.
that performed the same function. So
so the academics were coming up with ways to do things, but
right.
industry was figuring out ways to bring it to market.
Right.
So to realize what the sort of theoretical or experimental things.
Right.
Okay. So you were involved with the AACC for quite some time. In some ways,
I'm still an emeritus member.
Okay, and you did receive.
Being an emeritus member, I don't have to pay dues anymore.
So in the 1970s, your vice president Susan moves off. You're more removed from bench work, almost completely removed. Would you say?
Pretty much.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
You received in 1975 the American Association for Clinical Chemistry Award, the Is it Garillat?
Garillat Award.
Garillat Award. What is that award for? And
Bernie Garillat was a very early member of the association, and particularly from the New Jersey section.
Mm-hmm.
And he died, and so this was kind of a memorial reward for him. And it was presented to annually to a member of the association that they thought deserved it.
So sort of outstanding achievement in the
field. Yeah, right.
Okay. So did you know that you were going to be receiving the award?
No. Well, yes, I knew.
I mean, did you know well in advance?
Well in advance,
okay.
No.
Okay. So why is it that you received it in 1975? What was the reasoning behind it?
You'll have to ask the committee.
Okay. I was just wondering, you know, if they had a war presentation they might have mentioned. Was it for specific patents that
think it was for any specific one thing.
Okay. How did you feel about receiving that award?
Oh, I was pleased, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Getting recognized for the work you had done up to that point. Now, it also, I'm assuming, 1975 might be an interesting year in other respects, because within 5 years of that point, you're leaving Warner Lambert. And so I'm kind of curious to know if there was something going on in the company that sort of led you to wanting to leave by 1980,
yes.
Or was it just... Okay.
Yes, they hired a person between me and George Masters, who was the what was his title? Bob Schiff, who I immediately took an instantaneous dislike to, and it's all spelled out in the. In the memoirs.
Mm-hmm.
Are you reading that section?
I was looking for his name. I couldn't remember it. But yeah, I just came up with Bob Schiff's name.
Yeah. And so he was the senior vice president for research and he had responsibility for a number of different locations where at that time research was done. The main research was done at Mars Plains, of course, but we had a group in Germany and another group in Texas, I think.
So he was sort of the supervisor for all the vice presidents of research at various locations?
Yeah, right. Senior vice president.
Okay, and was that a was he filling in for someone else who was already in that position?
No, it was a new position.
It was a new position. Okay.
Yeah.
Did you know that the position was going to happen?
No.
Oh, so this was a surprise.
It was a surprise.
And not a happy surprise.
Not a happy surprise.
And you mentioned that you took an instantaneous dislike to him. What was it about? I mean, was it something about his management style that didn't fit well with?
You have to know the man.
Oh, it's that kind of dislike. So that's it, was that the main reason that precipitated your leaving Warner Lambert?
Yes.
Okay.
Definitely.
All right. Were there other things that no longer fit well? Sarah mentioned the fact that you kind of liked working on your research projects. Were you tired of the management aspects of things?
I never really enjoyed management as such.
Okay.
It went with the territory, though.
Okay.
So
did you ever consider asking to be demoted so that way you could be back at the bench?
No.
Okay. So, 1980, after 25 years at Warner Lambert, you decide to leave. Did you ever...
Well, I decided... Soon after Schiff arrived.
Okay.
But I wanted to be vested in the Warner Lambert medical plan, for example, before I retired.
Okay.
So I had to be a certain age. I've forgotten what it was. It 55, I guess. I think.
Okay.
And at that time, I had accumulated. My boss realized this. George Masters realized that Schiff was not going to be. There was a possibility that he and I would not see eye to eye.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, and I told him pretty much that, hey, this is bad news.
Mm-hmm.
And he offered me severance if I decided after trying to work with Schiff for several months or whatever,
mm-hmm.
that if I wanted to leave, he would give me severance.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured out that the day my severance would take me to the 55 years old, that was the day I was going to leave.
Were there other people at Warner Lambert that had similar feelings towards
Yes, Schiff? Yes. Okay. Ken Sumner, who was my manager or director of clinical investigation,
mm-hmm.
he left almost immediately.
Okay. Wow.
And he said, I don't trust Schiff.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I remember him saying to me exactly. And he turned out to be right, because 2 years after I left, or within 2 years after I left, Schiff was summarily canned, along with all the people he brought in with him, for lying about results on a cancer test. Which the data showed that it wasn't going to work,
mm-hmm.
and he hid that from. Yeah.
And I guess it was kind of good that you got out when you did.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Did you have a plan for what you wanted to do when you were leaving?
Yeah. I knew I wanted to be my own boss.
Okay.
And I knew I wanted to stay in the medical field.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I essentially started the Babson Research Laboratories, and which was an S corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And I built a lab in my house, which I provisioned with leftover stuff from whatever, to a great extent, but and I started working on projects.
Okay, so what was your home built lab like? I mean, what sort of devices did you find you needed to start your new company?
Well, I needed a spectrophotometer, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I needed valances.
Okay.
I needed a water bath.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these things, a lot of these things I was able to purchase, and some I was able to get from my prior employer.
Okay. And so, you know, you had spent so much time studying diagnostics, and you wanted to continue with it. Was there a specific area that had interested you? You had mentioned, you know, when we were first talking, and you know, the success of Versatol, you became interested in enzymes, and then there was Versatol E, and then there was an interest in coagulation for you. Was there a new area that interested you, or was this just like a continuation of?
Well, the most successful product in general diagnostics was blood gas control.
Mm-hmm.
Which was an ampuled control for pH, PCO2, PO2, for blood gas controls, for controlling blood gas measurements.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an idea, And these all had to be, they had a gas phase and they had to be equilibrated at the temperature that they're at 37 degrees, for example, mm-hmm. before they could be used. And they were essentially injected in the blood gas analyzer. And I had an idea for coming up with a they were all single-use ampules.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the second year of sales, they were like $6 million product, which was unprecedented, you might say, for general diagnostics.
Mm-hmm.
And I came up with an idea for making a multiple use, which didn't require equilibration because it didn't have a gas phase in it.
Okay.
And I got a patent on it,
mm-hmm.
and tried to peddle it, and had a number of companies that were interested in it.
So my first question is, how did you come up with the idea? Again, yesterday when we were talking about Versatol E, you'd mentioned, you know, some of the work of other scientists, their publications, your friend who was publishing some interesting stuff. You were just looking up what he was up to. How is it that you came about with this idea? I mean, was it just, again...
I don't know.
So it just came to you?
Yeah, just came to me.
So it's a problem that needed to be solved?
A problem that needed to be solved. And
you were going to solve it?
I thought I could come up with a good solution, and I did.
Okay.
But unfortunately, I was never able to sell it.
Okay.
But it gave me a lot of contacts in different companies in the diagnostics industry.
Mm-hmm. So you saw yourself selling to your ideas to diagnostic companies, not that you would necessarily become a diagnostics company.
No, I didn't. I didn't want to sell to customers.
Okay, so you wanted to be sort of a
laboratories.
Okay, so you were going to be a researcher that contracted with or sold your inventions, your ideas to the diagnostic companies, which would then sell it on to the users.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
Although I did end up selling to MedPath, which was then the largest laboratory in the world,
mm-hmm.
in New Jersey, a couple of products, which together were worth $10,000 a month to me.
Wow. Okay.
So.
And was that in the early portion of Babson, or was this?
No,
later
that
on?
Was well. I've forgotten exactly when. It was later on, I think, because I had sold one product, a non-isotopic immunoassay for prostatic acid phosphatase, to which I developed, and to Ortho down in Raritan, New Jersey. And they marketed it,
mm-hmm.
for a while, but then they really screwed up the marketing and they abandoned it for a while, or after about less than a year, I think,
mm-hmm.
and gave it back to me, the marketing rights. And so I made a presentation to MedPath, and I said, this is a good test. You ought to have it. You ought to use it. And I convinced them, and they started selling it.
Okay.
Or they started using it, I mean, not selling it.
Mm-hmm. So in the early years of Babson Laboratories, initially it was you.
Yeah.
Right. How did that company grow in the first few years? Because I know, I mean, you eventually moved out of here.
It was always me.
Okay.
I was the first employee and the only employee.
Mm-hmm.
So I was making reagents for Becton Dickinson for their Clay Adams division.
Mm-hmm.
Several reagents. Four, I think. and selling them in bulk, which they repackaged in single test units for their AccuStat analyzer, which was sold to the physician's office marketplace. And and I was also consulting for them.
Okay.
For like 5 years. And I ended up, after selling the prostatic acid phosphatase test to Ortho, I ended up consulting for them.
Okay.
For many years.
All right, so really in those first several years, it was just you.
Just me.
You and your home lab.
Yes, my home lab.
Your home lab with... and the contacts that you were able to make in the diagnostics industry, was that because people knew you from Warner Lambert?
Yeah.
Okay, so
you
had this reputation.
Oh, yeah.
People knew about you.
Right.
Now, one thing I did notice was that, and I think I probably know the answer to this next question, but I noticed that once you left Warner, I'd say for most of the 80s, you really stopped publishing.
Right, yeah.
Is that just because you were so focused on your own?
I was so busy making making money.
Making money. But if you had the chance, would you have continued publishing, do you think?
Maybe, I don't know.
You don't know.
I already had a number of publications.
You did.
A few.
That's true. That's true.
And there wasn't any money in publishing. Right at that time, I was interested in earning a living.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So outside of the initial work and the consulting work that you were doing in those first few years of Babson Laboratories, did you have any specific vision for what you wanted to achieve with the company, or was it just whatever work needed to be done, I was going to do it?
Pretty much.
Pretty much that.
Yeah, I didn't have any high vision.
Okay.
How to make a buck any way I could.
Were you doing, so putting work aside, were you doing anything in your own personal time, your leisure time, that was interesting to you? I mean, the last time we spoke about, you know, you like to go for walks in the woods. When we were having lunch the other day, I commented how there's, you know, beautiful land behind the building here. It seems like you could go for walks in. Were there things that you were pursuing in your own personal life at the time that, what were you doing when you weren't working? Or were you just working full time?
I was working pretty much full time.
Full time? Yeah. 7 days a week, no breaks?
7 days a week, probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So after those first few years, I know that eventually, I don't know if I have a clear understanding of when everything happened, but there was Pegasus Technologies, there was Cirrus Diagnostics, there was sort of an evolution of what you were doing, and also...
Well, this was totally separate from Babson Research Labs.
Okay, can you...
This was a new company. I had an idea for automating immunoassays.
Mm-hmm.
By spinning a tube on its vertical axis to do separations.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a patent on that.
Okay.
I actually wrote the patent application myself,
because
I already had 25 patents from, so I knew...
You
I
had
knew,
some experience.
Knew, yes. Mm-hmm. I knew what the routine was. And with the idea of selling it outright or licensing the technology, because I didn't visualize myself developing at Babson Research Labs.
And why not?
Well, I didn't want to be in the manufacturing.
Okay.
I made bulk reagents for Metpath and for Clay Adams.
Right.
Becton Dickinson, but That was great business.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want to have employees, for example.
Okay.
I liked working for myself.
Okay.
And so I got this idea. I wrote up a patent application and got a patent on it. And that's the basis of the technology you see here.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing a lot of consulting with a chap by the name of John Underwood.
Mm-hmm.
And John was... And I was essentially a technical backup for John. John was a consultant for marketing and whatnot, but he knew his way around the diagnostics industry
mm-hmm.
pretty well. And so I showed John this idea, and I said, "John, who do you think's a good customer for this?" And he took one look at it and he said, "Art, this is too good. You don't want to sell this. You want to start a company."
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't. I didn't want to start a company. But he was very persuasive, and he convinced me. And he introduced me to a early-stage venture capitalist, Art Kidd,
mm-hmm.
when we were on a consulting trip to a company in Minneapolis. I can't remember the name of it now.
Mm-hmm.
And because Art was a director of this company. And I showed it to Art, and he said, "Yeah, this is pretty good." So and a subsequent visit to Minneapolis, and I had taken a battery-driven model
mm-hmm.
of a tube spinner. Matter of fact, I have, and it doesn't exist anymore. This was my first wooden model,
mm-hmm.
I have a metal model that simulates or almost exactly the same design, which I had a model maker make for me here. And I set this up at a restaurant which Art Kidd had invited a few of his wealthy investors to.
Mm-hmm.
And I demonstrate the principle of axial centrifugation to do separations in immunoassays on the dining room table in a restaurant. And on the basis of that and subsequent investigations Art made and my background and whatnot, he decided to start the put up the early stage of venture capital.
Mm-hmm.
And that was incorporated as Babson Technologies.
Okay.
But before we had our first hire, besides me, I was the only employee at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I decided that, and John Underwood agreed that we don't. This is not a good name for a company because I don't want people thinking they're working for me. I think a lot of them think they're working for their own company.
Mm-hmm.
So we changed the names to Pegasus Technologies.
Okay.
And at a clinical chemistry meeting in Philadelphia, I think it was, in 1982, I walked into the exhibit hall, and there on the huge banner on the wall, Pegasus, automation and immunoassay. So we figured we'd had to change the name
mm-hmm.
of the company, and this was after we had several employees.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got all the employees together, and I'd solicited names
mm-hmm.
for the new company, and from all the employees. I think we had like 70 or so submissions. And we all sat down at the conference room table, which was a 4x8 sheet of plywood. And in the schoolhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And we went through this list. And Emulite was one of the suggestions, but we decided, oh no, that's we'll save that name for the
product.
The product.
Okay.
And Sirius, the star, I mean main star, and I think it's the Orion,
mm-hmm.
Was suggested, and yeah, we kind of liked that, but then somebody said, well, how about Cirrus? And yeah, we liked that even better. So we changed the name to Cirrus Diagnostics.
Okay.
Because there wasn't, and I cleared it through my lawyer,
mm-hmm.
to make sure that there wasn't any other
companies
named that.
Okay.
At least in this industry.
Mm-hmm. So I'll probably just refer to things as Cirrus.
Yes.
Acknowledging that there were some name changes over time. What was the relationship between Babson Laboratories and Cirrus? Or is it that Babson Lab shut down? None.
None. Well, Babson survived for the first couple of years and after Cirrus, but eventually
just shut it down.
Just shut down,
okay.
Yeah.
And during the time when both existed, what was Babson Lab still you in your home lab?
Yeah.
Or, okay.
Yeah.
And then you would go off-site when you were working at Cirrus?
Well, when we first rented a room in the schoolhouse, we rented one room in the second floor.
And
it was the chemistry lab, I think.
At this point, who's the we? Is it just John? And
No. Well, the board of directors... excuse me, of Pegasus or Nanceris was John Underwood, Art Kidd, and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the president, CEO, treasurer,
chief technical officer,
chief bottle washer. And we didn't have any other employees for a long time. I mean, we were incorporated in the summer of
June 19th, 1987 for Pegasus Technologies.
1987?
Yes. Or at least that's what I have in my records for Pegasus. I don't know when Babson Technologies was incorporated.
Oh, that was 1981 probably.
Okay.
Yeah. 1981.
I could have the date wrong, but
yeah, I'm not very good at dates.
Okay,
but I can look them up later and correct the record.
Sure, sure. So you were incorporated in the 80s in the summer.
Yeah, in the early 80s and late 80s. Yeah, 1987, I think, is probably when we were, but we didn't have any employees except me.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided that my first employee should be a mechanical engineer.
Why is that? Because you had to build a device.
I had the idea,
mm-hmm.
And the concept, but we didn't have any mechanical design except for my wooden model, which obviously wasn't adequate.
Was this your first foray into actually building devices? So previously when you were at Warner, it was coming up with tests, not necessarily devices.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
All right, yeah. So this is your first device.
This was my first actually instrument, you
instrument.
Might say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I had a hard time convincing. I had one room in the schoolhouse.
Mm-hmm.
I bought two secondhand desks. I had built a drafting table, and that was essentially the company. So how would I convince a mechanical engineer who is pretty conservative munch anyhow to come to work for Fly-By-Night Diagnostics? And it took me a while. My first hire was Tom Palmieri, a mechanical engineer, who started on May 15th, 1988, I guess.
Okay.
And
so almost a year after the incorporation.
Yeah, okay. almost a year.
What were you doing in the time between incorporating and hiring Tom? Was it just searching for people? Were you?
No, I was actually sketching out concepts.
Okay.
For
the design.
For the mechanical design, so that when I eventually did get a designer, I would have some, you know, direction for him to start on.
Okay.
And then, but after that, the company grew in terms of people by leaps and bounds. Was that first threshold of going from one employee to
two
employees convinced other people that wasn't a bad idea.
Did you necessarily know that you had a market for this device?
Oh, yeah.
Had you been shopping the idea around to anyone at this point, or is it still?
I don't know if I had shopped it around. No, I don't think I was shopping it around.
Okay.
I don't remember shopping it around.
Okay.
Once John convinced me that I shouldn't shop it around, that I should start a company, I didn't.
Okay. All right. So you have your first hire in May of 88.
March.
Okay. How did things progress? You mentioned that you started getting a lot more.
Yeah.
How did the company grow at that point?
Well, I had a mechanical engineer, and then I needed an electrical engineer. I needed a biochemist to do the assay development. And I hired Art Ross, who was an electrical engineer. He responded to a Time ad we ran in the New York Times.
Oh, really?
I got Doug Olson, who was eventually turned out to be president of the company when we were acquired by DPC. And I got him through a series of contacts that Johnny Teipel, I think it was, who was down in, who I'd met at Ortho when I was consulting for them. He knew of Doug, who was working with a startup at that time, which failed. And he knew him through a third party. So nobody, it was a strange chain of events, and I called Doug up, and he was interested, and we had an immediate rapport. And I remember I was interviewing him in my house in Mendham, because we just had the empty room at the schoolhouse, and my wife Susan also participated in the conversation, and then she excused herself and went out of the room. Telephone rang. It was Susan. She said, "Hire him." So she recognized his talent too.
Okay.
And so I did.
And so how long did it take you to effectively create your first instrument, to go from these ideas and these plans to making something. A working model.
Yeah. Well, it took about 9 months.
9 months. Okay.
Yeah, because we had venture capitalists, called vulture capitalists. they have they're very much concerned about targets, you know, target dates.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to, they say, well, they offered me a whole bunch of stock in the company, but only if I met these milestones.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a milestone at the end of the year, their first year, to have demonstrated the feasibility.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did. And I remember we were concerned about the label that we were going to use, whether or not it was going to be Aquadini Masters, which is a label used by some of our colleagues here in Bayer,
mm-hmm.
and or a enzyme label with a chemiluminescent substrate, which had just been announced in the literature.
Mm-hmm.
And so we built our first model such that it could use either.
Oh, really?
And we evaluated both of them, actually, mm-hmm. as labels. And we decided that the enzyme label was much preferred.
Mm-hmm. Based on just general testing results?
Yeah, okay. Based on actual results.
Okay. Now, how did you go about manufacturing this first device? Was this like...
We built three units.
Mm-hmm.
The gentleman that on Tuesday that hosted us for lunch,
mm-hmm.
Was one of the major builders.
Okay.
He was an electrical engineer, but he actually constructed the first units in the schoolhouse.
Mm-hmm.
We made. Three units we called the A units, and basically one of these we took to a clinical chemistry meeting in 1989, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And we also then, by this time we'd grown so much, we took over essentially the entire schoolhouse.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Schoolhouse building. And we had the entire second floor and most of the first floor and part of the basement even.
Mm-hmm.
And we built 12 instruments, which we called the B units.
Mm-hmm.
And those were actually, we sold one of those to our first customer, which was Morristown Memorial Hospital in Morristown, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And then we contracted for the C units, which were 25, which we paid $1 million for,
mm-hmm.
$40,000 apiece, to a company in Mountain Lakes, New Jersey. Forgotten the name of it. And then we moved out of the schoolhouse into our own facilities in Randolph, New Jersey, where we set up a manufacturing area ourselves.
So, I mean, was it, in terms of actually manufacturing the device, did the school have a machine shop that you were
making? We essentially did the final assembly.
Okay.
We weren't doing any machining at
okay,
all.
Okay, no in-house machining. No. So you were getting the parts made for you and,
right.
and reassembling
yeah.
them
yeah.
on site.
Yes.
Okay. Now, for someone who liked to work on his own, rose the ranks, and had to do a lot of managing without being hands-on anymore, leaving that position so that way he could work hands-on with things again, to then have another company or have a company that you were building and was growing and expanding, how did you respond to those changes? 'Cause I mean, you said that Underwood convinced you that you needed a company. You have a company, and now you have tons of people that you're responsible for again. Was this in some ways different from what you were experiencing at Warner, or?
Much different.
How so?
Much different. Because Cirrus Diagnostics was a tightly knit organization. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, and there was no politics involved. Mm-hmm. It wasn't part of a huge corporation like Warner Lambert, mm-hmm. a small division of a huge corporation. So it was our baby. Mm-hmm.
So there was just a different, complete culture.
Yeah,
there.
Totally different culture.
Okay, and was there any formalized structure to Cirrus at that time? I know that you obviously were in charge, but did you start creating a hierarchical structure in any way?
No.
Or was it was very just it was like people coming up with the name for the company were sitting around a table.
Yeah, right.
And just
no, there was different functions.
Right,
I mean, like
right.
mechanical engineering and electrical engineering, but it was a very collegiate group of so-called equals, mm-hmm. and we all pitched in.
Okay. So you make your A units, your B units, your C units.
Well, we contracted for the C units.
Contracted for the C units.
Yeah.
But it was still something that you were producing. That's all I really meant. Did you see this as being the device that Cirrus was going to make, or did you start thinking about what the next thing was going to be for Cirrus?
Well, we started on the actually, I had started on the next thing before we completed the Emulite, which was what we called the CRP, or the Cardiac Risk Profiler.
Right, that was the automated lipid profiling
right.
system?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because at that time, good cholesterol, bad cholesterol, and triglycerides were all the rage, you know, mm-hmm. for screening for susceptibility for potential heart attacks. Mm-hmm. And at that time, we had the venture capitalist, Art Kidd, had limited resources. Mm-hmm. And I thought that we could put something together pretty quickly, and we did, that would, based on the same principle of axial centrifugation, by moving fluids around, we could come up with a lipid profiler, mm-hmm. which did these LDL and HDL and total cholesterol and triglycerides. And
there's nothing on the market for this at the time?
There was one product, and I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, mm-hmm. that... But there was, I don't think there was a dedicated analyzer for this, that just did these analytes.
Okay.
We came up with one, and we went to Becton Dickinson. And they said, yeah, that's great. But, we went to them initially modified Emulite tube, mm-hmm. which would do 20 serum samples in about 30 minutes, mm-hmm. do a profile, complete lipid profile. Excuse me. We built this, and we went to Becton Dickinson, demonstrated it, and worked pretty well, but they convinced us that no, we don't really want an instrument that does 20 serum samples in 30 minutes. We want an instrument that does one blood sample, whole blood sample, in 12 minutes, because they want to market it to the physician's office laboratory, and the physician wants to have the results while the patient is still there. Mm-hmm. And the average patient was visit was like 12 minutes or something like that.
20 minutes, yeah.
Yeah. And so they said, well, this is what we really need. So we went back to work, and in a few months, we came up with the thing, which is in my office. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah.
Saw it.
Yeah.
And we built three of those, or had them built for us, mm-hmm. really. We didn't build them. And went back to Becton and Dickinson, and they said, well, that's pretty good. But how much we had an estimated manufacturing cost, which was too high mm-hmm. for their method of distribution, because they had several layers of distribution that they went through before they sold to the actual physician,
mm-hmm.
office laboratory, and so it was too expensive for them.
Did you think of trying to market this directly yourself?
No. The strategy was to work with a third party that would bring in some early cash flow into mm. the company.
Okay.
To make us less dependent on the venture capital.
Okay.
But we had no intention of manufacturing it or marketing it ourselves.
Okay.
But when Becton Dickinson pulled out, we started scrounging around for other potential customers,
mm-hmm.
and we found one out on the West Coast, who was very interested. And the lawyers were actually putting the final papers together when the FDA released the proposed CLIA, Clinical Laboratory Improvement Act, regulations. This was in 1988, CLIA 88 it was mm-hmm. called. But they didn't release them until 89 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
These proposed regulations would essentially put the physician's office market out of business. Because they didn't differentiate between different size laboratories.
Mm-hmm.
Every laboratory had to have a clinical chemist or a.
So they're instituting specific standards that would have made it
right.
too expensive for a physician to
right.
have
yes.
a laboratory yeah. in his or her
but
office.
But of course, these were the proposed regulations. By the time they got adopted, they were much less onerous.
Mm-hmm.
But so Chris Monahan out in Los Angeles I think he was in Los Angeles, did a about face and said, no thanks.
No thanks.
So we never were able to find another customer.
What about for the original idea that you had for, you know, getting 20 samples done in 30 minutes? Was there any way to revert back to that, because now it sounds like that would be much more useful
it had limited use in the clinical lab, I think.
Okay.
But we never explored that again.
Okay. So after the cardiac risk profiler, what is it that you wanted to do with Cirrus? What was the next idea?
Well, the main idea was the Immulate,
the
immunoassay analyzer, yeah.
Okay, so you decided just to continue
yeah,
with that?
Right, we just continued with that.
Okay, so how did that change and grow over time? I mean, you know, clearly you had your original device, but it's...
Well, we had, at the time, we had one customer, Morristown Memorial Hospital,
mm-hmm.
and at that time we were looking for an acquirer, because the venture capitalists they didn't want to start a standalone company. They wanted to get in and get out.
Right. They wanted someone to buy you up. and make profits off of it.
Yeah.
Right.
And so how did we get... I'm trying to think how we made contact with the Diagnostic Products Corporation initially.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't recall, tell you the truth. But they were... I had written Ziggy Ziering, who was the president of Diagnostics Products Corporation, and asked him if he was interested in marketing or making reagents for the instrument, because I think that maybe we were considering going in on our own.
Mm-hmm.
And he said no. He had their own division, had their own instrument that they were working on. Well, it was a joke, the instrument that they were working on. But
in what sense? It was just not a good instrument.
No, it was terrible, terrible idea. And but so I wrote to him again, and he came out, visited. And he had a spark of interest, and we were visited by three people from DPC, one of which was a woman that brought a whole bunch of samples, like 200 samples with her, which had been characterized.
Mm-hmm.
And she ran them on the Immulite in the schoolhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And the results were beautiful. And at that time, we had a little off-site manufacturing operation for the reagents. Mm-hmm. We had developed seven. Approval, government approval, FDA approval for seven different analytes.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, TSH, LH, FSH. Forgotten the others, and we were going to go it alone, but then Ziggy came in, and he got, basically we had a visit from several of his international distributors, and they convinced him that hey, this is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So he made us an offer, and which we took.
You couldn't refuse?
Well, no, we wanted, actually, he offered us $28 million and for the company, and we thought it was worth more.
Mm-hmm.
And we had one of our venture capitalists negotiating with him, but he wouldn't budge.
Mm-hmm.
We were trying to get him up to at least 30. But he acquired us in 92, yeah.
Okay. So
92 or 93?
I had 92 listed, but again, yeah. I can always be off by a little bit. What did the acquisition mean for your operations? I guess one question is, when did you move out of the schoolhouse?
Shortly thereafter.
Shortly after the acquisition?
Yeah.
Okay. So was that because DPC wasn't really happy with having you work out of a schoolhouse, or was it just that the company needed a change?
No, we needed, once we were acquired,
mm-hmm.
we obviously weren't working with third parties to manufacturing it. We wanted to manufacture ourselves. There's no way we were going to manufacture, even though we'd built 12 units there mm-hmm. in the schoolhouse, the B units, one of which is down in the lobby,
mm-hmm.
B1. I don't know if you
is
know.
That one of the ones that, right in the entryway?
Yeah.
Okay.
And right next, on the same side as the receptionist. Mm-hmm. That's the first Immulite that we sold to to Morristown Memorial, which was the first one that was built in the schoolhouse.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That was built in the schoolhouse. So we had to set up, find manufacturing facility. Mm-hmm.
So why
and
did
that's
you
why we moved to rented quarters in Randall, New Jersey.
Okay. So why is it that you wanted to do the manufacturing in-house? Did you just find that better quality control, or?
Better control, yeah, all the way around.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. And what was your role in the company then after the acquisition? Did it change in any respects? I guess what I'm curious about is, since I don't know, I mean, with acquisitions, you could have a situation where everything is taken, you're really incorporated into this new company, and what you had previously stops existing. But there's also the chance that you're bought by a new company, and they see that you work well as is, and they kind of leave you alone as long
yeah,
as you...
Yeah, they pretty much did leave us alone. Although, the president of DPC... oh, jeez. God, I can't think of his name. He became president of Cirrus.
Okay.
Which was... changed the name to DPC Cirrus at that time. I've got a metal block.
So there was the name...
So he divided his time between...
the two.
Between the East Coast and the West Coast.
Okay. And so nothing else changed with
no,
how
pretty much.
Things function?
Well, we
moved.
Obviously we moved and we added a whole lot of people, mostly in manufacturing.
Did you have specific factors that went into your choice of the new site in Randolph? Was there anything?
Yeah.
What were those?
Well, it had to be close by, because we didn't want to the existing employees, which we were about 30 by then,
okay,
in the schoolhouse, didn't want to have to commute long distances.
Okay.
So it was close by, and it was a nice facility, and we could essentially fit it out to our own
specifications.
Okay. So it was essentially empty space, and that was desirable.
Mm-hmm.
So we essentially designed the space, and it was the front part was administration or research labs and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And the back was manufacturing.
Were you still, were you still working nonstop as you had been?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I didn't slow down at all.
You didn't slow down? You didn't take a break or anything like that?
No.
No. Okay. Were you still at the bench doing work, or were you away from the bench more?
I was pretty much away from the bench at this
time. Away from the bench.
Yeah.
Okay. So you were
but
back
very,
in
very heavily involved in all of the plans.
Okay. Were you handling a lot of the research aspects of things or the
yeah.
administrative?
No, a lot of the research too.
Okay. Okay. And after the acquisition, after you moved to the new location, what were your responsibilities to your parent company? Is it that you had to manufacture? Did you have to drum up your own business? Did you?
No. Did we have to drum up our own business? Well, we weren't. DPC had. They had a very strong marketing group.
Mm-hmm.
And including in their number of international divisions, so they had marketing. They did the marketing for us.
Mm-hmm.
essentially.
So you just had to build the devices and refine their operation?
And they also, DPC, had reagent manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, they initially made a decision that they didn't, and we had a reagent group here,
mm-hmm.
In New Jersey, too. And they said, well, we don't need these people anymore. So they let them go.
Mm.
And shortly thereafter, they had to hire them because they realized, hey, this was a dumb idea. all of the expertise was resident in these reagent manufacturing people.
Mm-hmm.
So they shut down the we had a small reagent manufacturing facility where we coated beads and packaged them and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But we had the expertise was resident in the people.
Okay.
So they had to hire them back.
So what did you see DPC Cirrus doing? Or I guess the way to phrase this is, what did you want to change about your product?
We had the Immulite, which we're not manufacturing anymore. We were manufacturing a second generation Immulite 1000, we call.
Mm-hmm.
But I realized we needed this. This was a relatively small analyzer that required a lot of operator interface.
Mm-hmm.
I had to load the different tests on that. It didn't have essentially a reagent carousel, because the reagents were essentially loaded on manually.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought we needed a higher throughput second generation instrument, which would turn out to be the Immulite 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were already starting to work on that.
Okay. So it sounds like you wanted to automate things?
Yeah, totally automated.
And was there a reason for automating it? Did you have feedback from people saying, you know what, we're making mistakes when we're loading these things into the machine, or?
Not particularly, but the laboratories were at that time right now they're totally automated.
Mm-hmm.
You walk into a laboratory, you don't see anybody working at the bench.
Right.
They're just
machines in the background making noise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're just loading samples on the machines.
Mm-hmm.
So we could see that was coming.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you were getting on the automation track because it was happening more generally in the medical field. So what aspects did you want to of this device did you want to automate? Well, you mentioned one thing, the loading. Were there other parts that you wanted to automate more or change in some respect?
No, not really. We increased the throughput.
Mm-hmm.
We increased the number of tests that the menu of tests.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we totally automated the sampling, whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, the devices, the models on the wall here, are those the devices from this period of time, or did we pass by the devices that we were talking about earlier?
They're kind of concurrent.
Concurrent. So
yeah.
Can we spend a couple of minutes just talking about these various wooden designs? Because as I mentioned, I find them quite interesting. I guess part of what I'm curious about is how you were using these models? Were they simply just a way to convey your ideas to other people? Were you just comfortable? Did you like building models? And so,
well, it was a lot cheaper to build it out of wood than to build it in a machine shop out mm-hmm. of metal.
So this was sort of a proof of concept?
Proof of concept,
device?
Essentially, yeah.
Okay.
These are all proof of concept devices.
Okay, so could we talk about them possibly in sequence, like we did earlier?
Okay.
You can sit down or we could stand up, whatever you prefer.
No, we don't need to stand up. We had, and this was for the Immulite 2000.
Okay.
Where we had the Immulite test unit has the bead packaged in it.
Mm-hmm.
The Immulite 2000 used bulk beads and bulk reagents on a carousel,
mm-hmm.
but and bulk assay tubes.
Okay.
And these are the assay tubes for the Immulite 2000.
Okay.
And we needed a way to orient the tubes onto the essentially the incubation carousel.
Okay.
And this was a concept using essentially a rotating hook hopper feeder, as they call them.
Right.
And to see whether or not this was a feasible approach to doing that, taking bulk-loaded tubes and orienting them into a queue and then individually.
So looking at the design here, what I get is that you drop a whole bunch of tubes into a large
hopper.
And is it just purely random that a tube will get picked up? Is
yes,
that what you're
totally,
betting on?
Totally random.
And so as things turn around, as things move, it's churning this bulk
right, yes.
number. And so eventually one will be oriented correctly in order
right,
to be picked
that's
up.
That's exactly right.
Okay. And so the mechanism constantly rotates, it's constantly turning things around to pick something up and then drops it down into a little chute where
yep.
it's perfectly oriented.
Yep.
And then it makes its way into the analyzer.
Right.
Right. Okay. And so you mostly built that, you built it out of wood because it was cheaper. Actually, I think it's wood.
Well, there's hard cardboard and this.
And some tape. A lot of tape, I noticed, yeah. to keep things in place. And so did this start as an idea that you had in your mind? And
yes.
then it came to, so
yes.
then you built it. So it wasn't like you were sitting there playing with things and you.
No, no, I knew what I wanted to build before I started.
Okay. All right. What about this next device?
That next device was we needed to, after we incubated the bead with the sample and the reagent and so forth, we needed to separate the bead, the liquid from the bead,
mm-hmm.
and then we had to wash the bead.
Okay.
And we were washing it with an injector pump,
mm-hmm.
which would dribble.
Okay.
Which was bad.
Yeah.
So this device was to come up with a injector pump, which would incorporate what we called suckback after the fixed volume of fluid was delivered. In this case, water.
Mm-hmm.
It would suck back a little bit.
Right. So that way you wouldn't get the dribble.
You wouldn't. Yes, an anti-dribble injector pump.
Okay. And this was just, again, to test an idea?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what about the next one?
Well, that was when this guy bit the dust, that bead pack, which was designed for us by an outside firm,
mm-hmm.
we needed an alternative. And so this was a concept that would see whether or not we could bulk load the beads and singlicate them and deliver them one at a time
mm-hmm.
To the to the reagent, to the tube in the sample carousel, mm-hmm. or not in the sample, the incubation ring. And that worked very nicely.
So this uses a solenoid essentially to move a lever which opens a hole which would allow one.
Right,
to
one bead. And it also, there's this, what we called a disturber in there, which would reshuffle the beads, kind of.
Right, so nothing would get stuck.
So that the beads are kind of rough, mm-hmm. and they would bridge. So you have to keep mixing them up. And that's the same with that that loader, reloader.
Okay. And so the last device, if you want to explain, which is using string and rubber bands as well.
Yes, that's to the solid phase, which is on the bead, mm-hmm. and the reactants, which is the sample and the reagent, which are in solution. Mm-hmm. If you didn't mix the contents, the reaction rate would be dependent upon diffusion. From the liquid phase into the solid bead surface, mm-hmm. and that's very slow. So to speed up the kinetics of the reaction, you need to mix the bead, keep the bead moving, mm-hmm. and within the assay tube, mm-hmm. and this device would basically bump the bottom of the tube periodically back and forth. And that was incorporated in the Immulate, pretty much.
So, were they? I'm wondering if these models sort of stayed as is once they were incorporated. Like, if we looked at the device, would we just see, you know, metallic versions of these things, or were they modified in somewhat from their original design to complement the machines?
Well, yeah, very much so.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's mainly to capture
it's
a specific...
It's just to demonstrate a concept.
Okay. Okay.
So would you be bringing these like into the conference room and demonstrating them for a group, or...?
Sometimes, yes. Yeah.
So I'm guessing they sparked discussion, or...?
I had a time convincing people that this pump with suckback, for example... would be precise enough. So I collected a lot of data, and turns out it was more precise than the pump we were using.
Okay, so you'd basically be giving a presentation,
yeah,
backing
right.
these up.
Yes.
Did you have a wood shop here? Wood shop in the...
I had my wood shop at home.
At home. So
yes.
This is something you would do at night after...
Yes, right, absolutely.
Okay. Were you using that wood chop for anything else at the time? Or is it just your own personal...
My own personal wood chop.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were there other aspects, other models that you developed to come up with new concepts for that?
Sure there were. There's one in the picture there that... I think I have it in my bookcase at home, in my office.
Okay.
But these were the ones that would fit on the wall.
Okay.
Comfortably.
Okay. So now this automation, this is happening in the early 90s?
Yeah.
Is that when it's taking place? Are there other changes going on inside DPCers at the time? Were you still continuing to expand?
No, we were growing, you sure.
And what was the market like for your device? Was that growing as well? Was it a steady
yes.
market?
Yes.
And were
and,
you...
And there were a number of competitors at the time, too.
Okay. Like what other companies?
Bayer.
Mm-hmm.
Who was our main competitors at that time? Technicon, of course,
mm-hmm.
which became Bayer. don't remember, to tell you the truth.
Were their devices, I know this is going to be somewhat biased, but were their devices on par with what you were creating? Were there things about those other devices that you, earlier you had mentioned that, I think it was DPC had their own?
Well, DPC was working on a system which
had some problems.
Had a lot of problems, okay. Yes.
So were your competitors creating devices that had similar characteristics in terms of the data that it could generate to yours?
Our device was unique in that we used the actual centrifugation to do the separations and washings, and which was turned out to be very efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Other devices would use magnetic particles, let's say, as a solid phase, and then squirt in water, suck it out again, squirt it in, suck it out, and didn't work very well.
Mm-hmm.
Not as efficient.
So is it roughly around 1996, the mid-90s that you had your more automated immunoassay analyzer? I'm just looking at when your patents were, and there's a group of them, the tube washing system, the sample dilution system, and dilution well insert, the automated immunoassay analyzer. Those patents are these being issued somewhere in the mid-90s, and so I'm wondering if that's roughly when the more automated version of the Immulite system was coming out.
When did we market the Immulite 2000? Again, I don't remember, to tell you the truth. I'm not very good at dates.
Okay.
But I can certainly find out for you.
Sure. I was just wondering if it was around that general period of time. So it seems like somewhere in the mid-90s, you've developed a lot of automated techniques for this system. And I know in 1997, you received the New Jersey Inventors Hall of Fame Award.
Inventor of the Year Award from the New Jersey Inventors Hall of Fame.
Right. Can you tell me a little bit about that award, how it came about, how?
I believe John Underwood nominated me for the award.
Mm-hmm.
And they had New Jersey Inventors Hall of Fame had a committee that evaluated these nominations.
Mm-hmm.
And they made the selection. And we had a ceremony down in Newark. I had to wear my monkey suit. And they had a number of different awards that they had, annual awards.
Mm-hmm.
And I was only one of several recipients.
Was it acknowledging your entire career? I mean, you've done everything pretty much in New Jersey.
Yeah, pretty much, but it was mainly for the Immulite system.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. So after you came up with the Immulite 2000, what was the next step for this system? Were you looking to tweak the system more, or were you trying to think of new ideas to pursue, and were you receiving anything or any sort of guidance from your parent company, DPC, at the time about directions to go? Or
no, DPC, hi, Carol. DPC was totally dependent on us for the direction.
Okay.
except for marketing, of course, they were in charge of marketing.
Right.
But in terms of the technical aspects of the new systems, they didn't have any contribution to that at all.
Okay, so what is it that you wanted with these systems? Where did you see them going?
The newer systems, the Emulite 2000?
The Emulite 2000, or what would come after that?
Well, what has come after that is the Emulite 2000 XPI, which was just introduced, a year or two ago? Two years ago, yeah.
Okay. So what is it that you saw, what is it that you wanted to accomplish with the Emulite system after you came out with the Emulite 2000? What is it that you were trying to address that you needed a new model for? Was it just incorporating outside technologies or the general change in technological development that you needed to incorporate into the device?
We needed currently on the Emulite 2000 to change samples, you'd have to put the instrument into pause. And then it would take a while to re-crank it up again. And we wanted that totally automated. So that's where the XPI came in, to where we have total automation of the sample loading.
So it's now a continuous flow instead of like a batch system?
Yeah, more or less.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Okay. What else, if anything, was going on in terms of modifying these systems? I'm just wondering if
we were working on new systems like what we called what is now called the VersaCell, which was then called the SMS, sample management system. Which would basically totally automate the sample handling. The operator just bulk loaded trays of samples, and the robot would then pick up the sample, put it into the Emulite, where it would be pipetted. Then the robot would put it back into the sample tray. So this was a product that which is essentially our next product.
Okay. And was this something that, again, you were coming up with these ideas about how to push diagnostic clinical diagnostics in new directions? Because Emulite was, I had an idea, right, one day, and I thought people might need this. And so just that's what you worked on. I was wondering if you were having other ideas along those lines about devices that you might want to pursue or that you're thinking of pursuing at some point.
No. We were an immunoassay company.
Okay.
And we were just trying to improve the quarter-inch bead technology.
Okay. So can you take me a little bit through any other changes that were occurring within the company? I know that Siemens acquired you in 2006.
Right.
And so I'm wondering how that sort of came about. And also, if there were other changes going on within the company.
You have to ask Siemens that.
Okay.
But they decided they wanted to get into the in vitro diagnostics business. They weren't in it at the time, so they just willy-nilly bought up three different companies.
Okay.
And put them together.
So did that affect you at all in terms of how this company was being run, or was it just, it was an acquisition for them and they were happy with what you were doing and they were leaving you alone?
No, they didn't leave us alone.
Okay.
they They threw their weight around, you might say, mm-hmm. but it's been good.
Okay. At what point did you wind up coming over to this facility here? I guess, what time did you build this facility and come over here?
1991. I think it was 2001. Right.
2001.
Okay. I'm 10 years old.
I'm going to end up being on that date.
So what precipitated the building of this facility and the move?
Well, we ran out of space at the rental facilities in Randolph.
Okay.
And we just needed more space. Mm-hmm. So we bought this property, designed the building, and to our specifications, mm-hmm. and built it and moved in.
And this was still
the... We have 28 acres here, so we have room for a lot more expansion.
Lots of expansion. Okay. And you're still manufacturing everything on site?
Everything on site, yeah.
Okay. Did the character, or how would you describe the character of the company over time? Because clearly, I mean, initially, if you were, you know, selling only a few devices here and there to a very local group of individuals, I would assume that managing...
No, we had worldwide distribution right from the beginning.
Right from the beginning?
Well, not right after the DPC acquisition.
Right. I'm talking about thinking back to before the DPC acquisition, when it was just Cirrus.
Yeah.
Clearly, as you build these devices, you also, in many respects, take responsibility for those devices, right? So out in the field, if something goes wrong, I assume that you have to go, not yeah. necessarily you specifically, but someone from the company has to go and work with people. Maybe you bring people in to understand how to use the device. How did those aspects of the company develop and change over time?
Well, they grew mm-hmm. by leaps and bounds, you might say.
Okay.
Because we had at maximum we had how many people in field service?
At maximum?
Yeah.
Probably 50 or 60, right, before we...
So we would, and we had customer training here. Of course, this wasn't at the time of the DPC acquisition.
Mm-hmm.
We had Gene Hockmuth, the gentleman that took us to the lunch yesterday. He was field service. He started it, and he built up the group, mm-hmm. so essentially. But and we did customer training here. We started off small mm-hmm. and built a group. And now we have a lot of people.
And are things still operated roughly the same way now that they were when you were coming up with the name Cirrus? Is it still just people sitting around a desk coming up with ideas? I'm just trying to understand whether or not the structure of the organization...
Well, the structure of the organization since the Siemens acquisition has changed dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're totally integrated in several locations.
Right. I'm just wondering if the culture of the ideas, right, how things are thought up and implemented, right? You know, in the schoolhouse, you were working closely with a lot of individuals, and it seemed like, people working together to come up with devices,
yeah.
instrumentation, how to build it, and things like that. Does that aspect of things still exist now, or has
yes.
that changed?
Yeah.
Okay.
I would say it still exists now, except it's distributed.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our new projects, for example, are distributed between Flanders, Glasgow, Delaware, Tarrytown, New York.
And how is it? How is that sort of managed? Are do people from this facility travel to other facilities, or is it just like a movement, a shuffling of people around on a regular basis to for meetings and things like that?
Yeah.
Okay. And so everyone's kind of kept in the loop about everything that's happening.
Right.
Okay. All right. Now, some of the materials that you sent us to prepare for this interview weren't technical documents, right? They weren't published papers published scientific papers. You sent one piece that talked about belief systems, the world being round, the world being flat.
Oh, those are my personal essays.
Your personal essays.
That's got nothing to do with the company.
I know that has nothing to do with the company, but I'm actually interested in hearing a little bit about what inspires you to write those personal essays, and what sort of audience are you writing those personal essays?
Well, the audience is mostly me.
Okay.
I get inspired by, for instance, the one that Guns for Everyone was inspired by an incident, you know, in the schoolhouse where, or not, not the schoolhouse, our schoolhouse, but and where some kids were killing each other.
And you had the one about the litigious society, and I'm just curious, what motivates you to write those pieces? Because I actually haven't met many people that sit and write personal essays like that actually reflect on things beyond their own career. So I'm curious why it is that you write those things.
I don't know.
You don't know
the truth. I've got a whole book of essays. You'd be interested.
Is it something you've done throughout your career, just kind of when you have the time, or is it only something that's maybe more recent?
Well, and by more recent, you mean last decade or so?
Right.
Yeah, probably.
Okay. Are there any things that I don't actually have any more questions myself. And what I usually like to do at the end of the interview is try to give the interviewee a chance to talk about something that either related to your work, to your research, or anything more broadly that I haven't, you know, asked about. You know, sometimes I throw this question out and people start talking to me about science education in the United States. Sometimes I throw out this question and people get into the fact that actually for the past 20 years they've devoted much of their free time to volunteering at the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. So I'm trying to capture as much as I can in this oral history, but there's a lot of stuff I don't know about, so I'd like to give you a chance to bring up some topics that you find interesting that we could possibly discuss. But if you have nothing, that's also fine as well.
One of the things we didn't mention was that Susan and I, and it's in the memoirs, Susan and I built our own house.
Okay. When was that?
In shortly after we were married. That was early 1980s.
Okay.
Took us 3 years.
Did you literally build it yourselves?
Literally built it myself.
So,
would that require some
every board and
did that require a lot of learning on the job? I mean, was that something that you and Susan had to figure out how to do, or did you have some experience?
I've always been into building stuff, but as demonstrated by the models on the wall here, I always wanted to build a house, and we were lying in the hammock one day, and I said, "I'd like to build my own house." And he was very enthusiastic. She said, yeah, let's do it.
So where were you going to, where did you wind up building?
Well, right, actually right next door to where we were living.
Oh, okay, so an easy commute.
So we bought the 6-acre lot. Mm-hmm. Susan and her prior husband, David, had already bought it. Mm-hmm. And after Susan got divorced, and I got divorced, and we got married, we bought it back from David. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're living right now. So okay. It was very convenient because we were living right next door mm-hmm. to where we were building the house.
So you could go out at four in the morning?
We would go out, not 4 in the morning, but every afternoon after work, go home, change our clothes, go over to the building site, work till dark, and go back and have dinner and go to bed.
And anything else while you were building, other than building that house?
Anything else I was building?
Anything else you were building, or were there other things that you were doing while you were building that house? Because I'm assuming you still had some free time, but probably just joking.
Yeah, we got interested in Africa, mm-hmm. And we spent a lot of time in Africa. We mostly on safari, mm-hmm. but also involved with the Cheetah Conservation Fund in Namibia. Mm-hmm. And I was on a board of directors at the Cheetah Conservation Fund, for example. Mm-hmm. And we spent a lot of time and resources supporting them.
What was the pull for you for that?
I liked animals.
Liked animals?
I loved animals, yeah. Mm-hmm. If you end up with reading the... Did you look at the pictures in the back?
I was hoping that you would bring up the raccoons without me prompting.
Well, I've always been interested in animals. I've mm-hmm. always liked animals. Mm-hmm. We have 3 cats at home now. And Susan feeds. I don't know if you noticed that picture on my desk of the 2 bears and the cat and the
sun. I hadn't. I'll have to take a look.
Yeah, but. Take a look at that. Susan feeds all the animals. and we raised a couple of sets of raccoons. Mm-hmm. From the first set was, they wandered in one day. And we opened the door and they walked into the bedroom. Our bedroom is on the ground floor. Mm-hmm. And the second set fell out of the nesting tree.
Oh.
And we had to nurse them with a bottle. Mm-hmm. And bitch's milk. Mm-hmm. But they were a lot of fun.
How much time did you spend in Africa doing... Well, how much time did you spend there?
Well, we made... I think we've probably been there at least a half dozen times, or probably more.
What parts?
Kenya, Tanzania, mm-hmm. Zambia, Namibia. Mm-hmm.
And how long would you?
We'd go for like a month.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is there a reason, cheetahs specifically?
Yeah, we always liked cheetahs, mm-hmm. and Susan got involved with Lori Marker, who's head of the Cheetah Conservation Fund in Namibia. Mm-hmm. We've been there a number of times.
I noticed, I think it's the December, maybe the November issue of National Geographic is all about big cats and conservation. Uh-huh. So it's just interesting that that was something I didn't necessarily know about you. Are there any other things that you would want to discuss? Any other topics that you're interested in or you would like to talk about?
I don't think so.
No? 'Cause the remembrances that you provided
It's dated December of 1995, so
yeah,
I wasn't sure.
Yeah, and there's an update in the end there. I don't know if you've gotten to it yet.
Addendum. I mostly focused on the pictures and didn't get past those. Okay. All right. The Van Slyck Award for outstanding contributions to the science of clinical chemistry in 98. I didn't know about that one.
Oh, you didn't know about that one?
No.
It's on my wall in my office.
But I didn't see your office before conducting the interview. So what was the Van Slyck Award? Was that the only other award that you received?
That was the only other award that I got from the Clinical Chemistry Association.
And that was for your continued work in the
right.
the field? Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else?
There was the New Jersey Inventors
right.
Hall of Fame Inventor of the Year Award, mm-hmm. which is also up on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And the one that Carol showed you,
mm-hmm.
that was the Lifetime Achievement Award from Siemens,
right.
which I got just a year ago.
Right. Okay.
In Germany. I think it's the first and only Siemens Lifetime Achievement Award.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was kind of nice.
Yeah, that sounds great. Is there anything else you want to talk about? No?
Not really.
Okay. All right, well, thank you very much.